Gold has been a great motivator throughout human history. Why did California become a state 10 years before Oregon? Well, in part because of the California Gold Rush. So where did miners go when California claims played out? Some came to Oregon. What is it with gold? Our next guest attempts to answer the question in a modern context in a book called The New Case for Gold. The author is James Rickards, who's a portfolio manager, lawyer, and economist with a long history in the financial business, including more than three decades on Wall Street. He was general counsel at the hedge fund Long Term Capital Management when a Fed-guided bailout saved it from disaster in 1998. He is currently the editor of the newsletter Strategic Intelligence, and Jim Rickards' earlier book, The Death of Money, brought him to the exchange 2 years ago. Welcome back to the exchange, Jim Rickards.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be with you.
Interesting to look at where your mind tends to work. I mean, you're still talking in terms of collapse for somewhere in the near future, aren't you?
Absolutely, and that was the subject of my second book, The Death of Money. But when I talk about the collapse of the international monetary system, you shouldn't think of, you know, the end of the world or everyone living in caves and eating canned goods. It's just a breakdown of the existing system. By the way, I've spoken recently. I spoke to Ben Bernanke, you know, former chairman of the Federal Reserve. I had a separate conversation about 9,000 miles and 2 months apart with the former head of the IMF, John Lipsky. So here you have, you know, the head of the Fed and the head of the IMF. And they both use the same word to describe the international monetary system. They use the word incoherent. Now, I know they didn't rehearse that for my benefit. It just shows that, you know, the leaders, the power elites are all thinking along the same lines. We don't have a gold standard. We don't have a dollar standard. We don't have any frame of reference. What we have are currency wars, countries, you know, fighting each other, devaluing the currencies, taking turns, China, Japan, Europe, UK, US, etc. That's just a matter of time before it breaks down. And it's happened three times in the past 100 years, roughly 1914, 1939, 1971. When it happens, it's not the end of the world. But what it does mean is that the major trading and financial powers get together, sit in a room around a table, and they reform or recut the deal. So what I'm trying to do for readers is look forward, see the collapse coming, which I can do using dynamic systems analysis, then say, what will the new system look like based on conditions, and then come back to today, and what can investors do today to preserve wealth when this breakdown comes? So that's the purpose. I wrote two books along those lines. Each one had a chapter on gold, and finally I said to myself, you know what, I just want to sit down and write a book just about gold. Take everything I've learned, my research, my conclusions, conversations I've had, put it all in one place, make it really accessible for the readers, and then instead of touching on it here and there, just have a book on gold. And that's the purpose of my book, The New Case for Gold.
So money, including American money, was once pegged to the value of gold. It is not any longer. Why do you want it to be again?
Well, I don't necessarily think we have to have a strict gold standard, although I do think we'll end up there because it might be the only way to restore confidence in a breakdown. But at least have gold as a frame of reference. You know, it's kind of like you're a doctor, you have a patient. How do you know if the patient's, you know, well or ill? Well, one of the things you do is use a thermometer. You put the thermometer in the patient's mouth and have a look. Gold can be a thermometer of monetary policy. It can tell you if it's too hot or too cold. So it does have uses. But the main purpose of gold, it prevents the government from stealing your money by inflation. If the government creates inflation, it makes your money worth less. In effect, they're taking your money away. Governments are very good at that. We have a, you know,
you're talking about by printing money, by adding to the money supply, the paper money supply?
Well, that's part of it. But, you know, causing inflation by printing money is like trying to make a ham and cheese sandwich with ham. You need the cheese. There are two things you need to cause inflation. One is printing money. Yes, you have to increase the money supply. But the other one is you have to increase the turnover of the money. The technical name is velocity. If the money's printed and it just sits there in the banks, which is what's going on today, you don't get much inflation. But if you turn it over, if you spend it, in other words, then you will get the inflation. Now, people don't want to spend money. This is a behavioral thing, a psychological thing. People don't want, they're scared. They do want to pay down debt, and they can, leave it in the bank if they can, but they don't want to spend it. So the new thing that's coming, it's called helicopter money. That's a, you know, conjures up this image of the Fed printing money and pushing it out of helicopters. That's the way Ben Bernanke and Milton Friedman described it at various times. But the way you technically do it is you increase the budget deficit. The government spends the money. In other words, if the people won't spend the money, which they're not, the government will spend the money. That will increase the deficit. The Treasury covers the deficit by issuing more bonds, and then the Fed prints money to buy the bonds. So you still have money printing, but now instead of the money just sitting in the banks, which is what's happening today, the government actually goes out and spends it. And if they start building, you know, roads or bridges or giving defense contracts, that money will get spent. But with all the money that's been printed, the result is inflationary. So I recommend investors have 10% of their assets in physical gold. That will preserve wealth when the inflation comes. By the way, just to be clear, I'm not a gold salesman. I'm not selling gold. I am an author, a researcher, an economist, and an analyst. So I'm trying to kind of educate people and warn people, but they have to, you know, hopefully read my book, The New Case for Gold, and then draw their own conclusions.
The book is indeed called The New Case for Gold, and James Rickards wrote it. He's our guest on The Exchange. You can join the discussion, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jim, you reject the idea that gold lacks intrinsic value, but isn't it valuable only because we attach value to it? I mean, if it were plentiful and not shiny, would it be as valuable?
Well, if it were plentiful, and I don't think the shiny part matters that much, but the scarcity absolutely matters. But see, gold is not impossibly scarce. It is scarce. It is rare. That's true. But it does grow about 1.6% a year. That's how much all the miners in the world, they add to the global supply of gold, about 1.6% per year. That's roughly in line with population growth. And actually, so what that means is that it's a natural form of money. I don't know why that is. We don't need to get into, what the deeper meaning of that is. But it just happens to be the case that it grows pretty much in line with population, which means it's a very stable form of money. You can't print it. You can't pull it out of thin air the way you can with other kinds of money. It does grow, but it doesn't grow too fast. And the price of mining goes up. If inflation picks up for other reasons, namely discretionary monetary policy, the price of mining goes up, and that slows down the gold output. So it actually has a natural equilibrating mechanism. It's worked fine for thousands of years. It worked fine, you know, from 1835 to 1913, which is a period of great prosperity and growth in American history. We had no central bank. There was no central bank from 1835 to 1913. We did have a gold standard, and it worked fine. So it can work. Most of the arguments against gold are myths. When I say myths, they don't hold up to scrutiny. The red herrings, they're factually, historically, analytically incorrect. And part of what I do in the book, about 90% of the book is an affirmative argument in favor of having gold. But about 10% of the book, right at the beginning, I knock down these myths. Because if you go to talk to your friends, go to a cocktail party and say, oh, you know, I put some of my retirement money in gold, people will laugh at you. They'll call you a gold bug or a gold nut or a wing nut. They'll say, what's wrong with you? Don't you understand? You know, it has no yield, and all these arguments. And I had to knock them down. I was so tired of hearing them myself. I said, I'm just going to put it all in one place and make it easy for the readers to understand that these arguments do not hold water, and then go ahead and make the case in favor of gold.
All right. So if you're buying it, though, as a hedge against concerns about economic collapse, I mean, if you need to convert gold to something liquid, how would you do that? I mean, it'd be great if everybody else can't get to the ATM and so forth. You lay these scenarios out in the book. But then if you do have gold, how do you convert it into something that a merchant can use?
Well, first of all, in a really dire scenario, I'm not saying this will necessarily happen, but, you know, if the power grid's out, the banks are closed, there's social unrest, et cetera. People will take gold. You can just spend it. And that, by the way, that was common up until around 1914, around the beginning of World War I. People had gold and silver coins in their pockets. In fact, when I was a kid in the early 60s, a quarter or a dime was pure silver. You know, I had a paper route, and, you did odd jobs or whatever to make 25 cents was a lot of money to a 10-year-old kid. That was a pure silver quarter in as late as 1965. So it does work. It's been around forever, but we got rid of it. We got rid of it on the advice of economists who have been ruining the economy ever since, you know, taking us in and out of recessions. Just take 1987. The stock market crashed 22% in one day, October 1987. 22, not a week or a month, but in one day. In today's Dow Jones Index, that would be the equivalent of 4,000 points. So if the stock market were down 400 points, it would be, you know, front page news. Imagine it going down 4,000 points. That's what happened in 1987. 1994, the Mexican peso crisis. 1998, the long-term capital management collapse. I was personally involved in that. We were hours away from shutting every stock and bond market in the world. That's not an exaggeration. Alan Greenspan testified to that. I saw it firsthand. 2000, the dot-com bubble crashes. 2007, the mortgage market collapses. 2008, Lehman Brothers and AIG, and people lost 30-40% of their wealth. So this happens almost like clockwork every, 6-7 years. It's been 7 years since the last one. I mean, what are people waiting for? We're getting closer to the next collapse. It'll be bigger and more vicious than the last one. By the way, the next time this happens, which will be soon, the banks are not going to be able to paper it over. They did the last time. The next time, they're going to shut down. They're going to lock down the system. They're going to suspend redemptions of money market funds, close banks, reprogram ATMs so you can only get $300 a day for gas and groceries, close the stock exchange. And when I say things like this, Jeffrey, some people roll their eyes and like, oh, that will never happen. Every one of these things has happened. In from July to December 1914, the New York Stock Exchange was closed for 5 months. In 1933, the president issued an executive order shutting every bank in America. It didn't say when they were going to reopen. So the New York Stock Exchange closed down during Hurricane Sandy, 9/11. These things happen all the time. I'll give you a concrete example. Last week, the country of Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world, had $100 million on deposit with the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, which is arguably the safest bank in the world. That money disappeared. Just disappeared. And listeners can Google it. Just Google Bangladesh, Federal Reserve, $100 million. You'll find the story right away. That was wiped out digitally. Vladimir Putin has a 6,000-member cyber brigade. These are not criminal gangs. These are Russian military and intelligence assets working day and night to penetrate, destroy, disrupt, delete, and erase digital wealth. I run into people. You say, what do you have? They say, oh, I got money market funds, bank deposits, stocks, bonds. I say, no, you don't. You don't. You have electrons. You think you have wealth. What you have are electrons that can be erased. So one of the advantages of physical gold is you can't hack it, you can't delete it, you can't erase it. So it's another way to preserve wealth against all these threats.
I'm looking at what you're talking about the Bangladesh $100 million, an article in the New York Post from March 9th, it looks like. So, yes, we did Google it, and yes, it's true. I want to ask you, though, and we're talking to Jim Rickards here on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The New Case for Gold. So it's two pathways here. One, to take care of your own wealth. But let's come back to the idea of a gold standard. I mean, what, for example, would be happening in the economy now if the dollar were still backed by gold, or what wouldn't be happening?
Well, what wouldn't be happening is you wouldn't have $4 trillion of printed money on the Federal Reserve balance sheet. The Federal Reserve wouldn't look like a really bad hedge fund, which it does. The Federal Reserve balance sheet is a public document. You can just go to Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, click through a few links, find the balance sheet. They are leveraged 113-1. In other words, they have $113 of liabilities for every $1 of assets. Now, banks, a normal commercial bank, is leveraged about 12-1. Brokers are leveraged 15-1. A hedge fund usually doesn't leverage more than about 3-1. And yet here's the central bank leveraged 113-1. It's incredibly leveraged, and they've printed $4 trillion, so that would not be happening. Now, it is true that we don't have much inflation in the system today. That is true. But that's because the money is just sitting there. But what's coming next is what they call helicopter money, which is basically the idea behind that is, if the people won't spend the money, right now they're not because they're fearful, if the people won't spend the money, the government will. So they'll spend it on, look, if it's Democrats, it'll be Medicare, Medicaid, environment, education. If it's Republicans, it'll be defense. They'll probably do both, right? Republicans and Democrats, the way they compromise is they both get what they want. Spend more money, increase the deficit. The Treasury will issue bonds to cover the deficit, and the Federal Reserve will print the money to buy the bonds. So this way, if the people won't spend money, the government will. They'll get the inflation sooner or later. Not much has happened lately, that's true. But they're not going to give up trying. The government has to get the inflation because it's the only way out from under $19 trillion of debt. You have to inflate it away. When that happens, the price of gold will soar. So you've got two vectors pushing up the price of gold. One is this helicopter money, which you can see coming. The other one is a financial panic, which you can also see coming. I don't know which one's going to hit first, but probably both of them will hit. But the problem is when the price of gold starts to soar, when I say soar, up $100 per ounce per day, $200 per ounce per day, you're going to be watching that on TV. You're not going to be able to get the gold. There are already physical shortages. I just got back from Switzerland. I met with the head of the world's largest gold refinery. Here's a guy. So what does a gold refinery do, right? They take gold in the front door. They process it and send it out the back door. So he knows all the big sellers, all the big buyers in the world. He sells 10 tons a week to China. He said, China wants twice as much. They'd like to buy 20 tons a week. He said, I won't sell it to them because I can't source it. I've got other customers. But he's seeing shortages on the incoming side. He's finding it harder and harder to get the gold that he needs to melt down and sell to the Chinese. So we're already seeing physical shortages. You can see the helicopter money coming. You can see the instability of the system. This is not crystal ball stuff. I mean, I document all this in the book, The New Case for Gold. But when this happens, you're not going to be able to get the gold. The time to get it is now.
So if the system is constrained, that you can't increase the money supply when it is constrained by how much gold is available to back it, it raises the question about, this most recent financial downturn. Would we still be in that recession, or is your point that we wouldn't have gotten into it in the first place if the money had not been so freely available?
Well, the second point is definitely true. We wouldn't have gotten into this in the first place. If, you know, the Federal Reserve is like an arsonist with a fire truck. Like, so they burn down the economy, then they show up with a fire truck and put out the fire, and they say, gee, aren't we wonderful? We put out the fire. I say, yeah, but you started the fire. You caused the fire. In other words, it was Alan Greenspan's monetary policy keeping rates too low for too long between 2002 and 2005 that caused the mortgage bubble that collapsed in 2007 and 2008. So they caused it. Now they want to take credit for putting it out. They're causing the next one. The Fed is just reckless. So you get into these boom and bust cycles, but you know, everyone loves the Fed because they bailed us out in 2008, but people lose sight of the fact that they caused the crisis and didn't see it coming. Ben Bernanke said in 2007, when the mortgage market started to melt down, he goes, oh, this will blow over. And that's a public record. He said, this will blow over. Well, it didn't. It almost destroyed the world. Then they printed all this money. So you wouldn't have this boom-bust cycle to begin with. But to your point, Jeffrey, about, wouldn't it constrain discretionary monetary policy? The answer is no. And I spoke to Bernanke about this personally because he's before he was on the Fed, he made his reputation as a scholar of the Great Depression. And I read his book, and I spoke to him personally. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, because one of the raps on gold is, you can't expand the money supply. You can. The law in 1929, 1930, was that the money supply could be 250% or 2.5 times the gold supply. So take the gold at the time, $20 an ounce, whatever that number is, multiply by 2.5, and that's how much money you could print. How much did the Fed actually print during the Great Depression? The answer is 100%. In other words, it was never more than 1 times the gold supply. So the Fed could have more than doubled the money supply in the Great Depression and still be on a gold standard. So the failure in the Great Depression wasn't gold. It was a Federal Reserve monetary policy, and that's what Milton Friedman, Anna Schwartz, actually that's what Ben Bernanke said. So when I met him, I said, Mr. Chairman, I've read your work, and it seems to me that gold was not a constraint on increasing the money supply during the Great Depression. I said, do I understand that correctly? He said, yes, you do. And I knew I had it right because he was the one who showed it. So Bernanke personally confirmed to me that gold was not a constraint on the money supply during the Great Depression. It's not a constraint today. You can have a gold standard and still print money, but the gold keeps you honest. It keeps you from printing too much money. It keeps you from having inflation or keeping rates too low too long and wiping out people's wealth.
Well, you certainly get people thinking in the book. It is called The New Case for Gold. Jim Rickards is its author and our guest on The Exchange. Jim, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you.
All right, take care.